Have you experienced a mental fog or pervasive emotional pain that you're unsure where it's coming from? It could be from what's called cognitive dissonance. In today's episode, Carrie and I will delve into what it is and how that deception can keep us stuck. And the self-help tip today is on how to use HOLT to help you get back to basics.
Thank you for joining us on Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse, where we talk about strategies, tips, and tricks on navigating and recovering from narcissistic abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie McAvoy, a mental health clinician with over 20 years' experience and author of Love You More, a graphic inside look at my experience of a toxic relationship.
And I'm your other co-host, Tara Blair Ball, a certified relationship coach and abuse survivor and author of Reclaim and Recover, Heal from Toxic Relationships with a 7-Step Guided Journal. When I was in my unhealthy and abusive relationship, my first marriage, I struggled with basic math. I couldn't even calculate a tip on a restaurant bill. And it was this ongoing joke with my ex that, and he would ask me questions like, how did you graduate high school math? Or how did you get a master's degree? And I would constantly feel befuddled that I couldn't do this. I literally couldn't calculate like $12.97 plus $3. I just really struggled with it. I'd have to use a calculator on my phone. And it was this ongoing joke where I just felt really embarrassed. I would make sure to shove the receipt over to my ex that I wasn't having to calculate that and things like that. And then I left that relationship. And I was at the time a teacher, and I remember calculating grades, and I suddenly had no problem doing it. And it was this moment where I was like, why? How can I suddenly be able to do this now when I had so many problems when I was in that relationship? And the trauma therapist that I was working with at the time said that I was probably struggling with the impact of cognitive dissonance. And that was the first time I'd heard of the term before. Do you hear about this a lot, Carrie?
I do, but people don't usually have a terminology or a name for it. Usually just come in and describe not functioning well. Like you said, not doing basic things, or they're feeling forgetful, scattered. They often use this word fog. I feel like I'm in a mental fog.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, as I was listening to your story, I thought, how that must have been so harmful to your sense of self. I had the same thing happen. It wasn't like there was a particular skill that deteriorated on me, but I remember searching for words or feeling like I was not together. I felt kind of scattered and definitely not functioning at my best, which made me feel really insecure. Did you start to feel kind of like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. I mean, I could look back and see that I had graduated from high school with honors, graduated from college with honors. I had a master's degree. I was teaching a very intensive and difficult subject, yet I wasn't able to do this really, really basic thing. And so, yeah, it did make me feel very insecure. I thought I was this really intelligent person, and yet faced with something as silly as 3 plus 1297, I struggled calculating. And yes, it did impact my self-esteem and feelings of self-worth, and just made me feel really insecure about something that I had felt sure about for most of my life, just being smart and intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where it showed up for me was I'm a extremely decisive person. Even when I, like if I decorate a house or whatever, when I walk into a furniture store, I just quickly like, I want that and that. I mean, I just make really big decisions really fast. And I'd even bought and sold houses and was in the real estate business for a little bit of time and was able to do that really well and made really wise decisions. And what I found was that what threw me was when in the middle of all of that, I couldn't decide to stay or go, and I would waffle. I would say out loud, I would like confide in a friend, oh, I think this is it. He's really done something stupid. It's really hurt my feelings. This is the thing. This is if he's crossed the line. And then a few days later, I'd be completely in another position and I'd say, no, he's not. He's really working hard, and I know he's working so hard, and I really want this to work. And they would look at me thinking, like, you just told me this awful thing that happened last week, and now you're back thinking he's working hard at it? And I would feel so like an idiot. In fact, what had happened is I stopped talking to people. I just stopped letting them in on that because I was crossing a line back and forth so rapidly that I couldn't keep it straight. And then I looked at myself as if I was my own psychologist thinking, you're crazy. This is, you know, clients who come in like this, you end up thinking or they don't know what they want, or they're very confused, or you struggle with with how to work with them. And you're them. Now you're them. I felt humiliated. I didn't recognize myself.
It was really easy for me to feel really embarrassed and ashamed because of that, for the same reason that I was in a relationship with someone who broke our dining room table when we were engaged. And how could I stay with that person who physically intimidated me, who was physically frightening, yet I could go ahead and tell my friends who were dealing with lesser and more minor sort of abuses, how can I tell them to leave or that they need to make better choices for themselves when I was habitually going back to a relationship that was abusive, that was frightening and scary to me? And I was always doing it because out of this premise of love. Mm-hmm. Oh, he loves me. I love him. Yet, how can you equate abuse with love?
Yeah. And for me, it was that I just wanted to wish the best. I really, really believed that, kept hoping. It was to the point that I stopped telling people the whole story. I would just tell a curated version of things that would line up with what would make sense with my behavior. Sort of like I don't know if people know the word confabulation is when somebody has dementia and they just sort of fill in and make it look like they know what they're talking about and they don't. I was sort of doing a version of that where I was just filling in and making it all look consistent when it really was not a consistent picture. So when I came across cognitive dissonance and started reading, especially with Kristen Milstead's book, Why Can't I Just Leave, was terribly impactful for me. And so was Sandra Brown's work with her big studies out of Purdue. It was like a light bulb came on for me. And suddenly I realized that it wasn't, I thought there was something wrong with me, that I was just more shaky than I thought I was. I found out that it was a condition that was happening to me that caused this. This is common, that anyone who's in a narcissistically abusive relationship will experience this. And one of the things that Sandra Brown said that when I was in her continuing education training, she said this and it just set me back. She said, this is the most agonizing experience for people who are going through it. They find it the most intolerable thing and they're in tremendous emotional pain. I didn't weep because I was trying to listen for my continue education credits, but I felt so much relief. It was like, yes, that it was agonizing. What I was experiencing was agonizing. And I knew part of what made it so horrific was the isolation that it brought. Not only that I felt crazy myself, but I couldn't share it with anybody because I looked crazy sharing it. It was, wow. So when did you come across the term? When did you learn about cognitive dissonance?
It was the trauma therapist I'd worked with shortly after leaving my ex-husband that pointed it out, that that's what I had been experiencing while I was in that relationship, why I was experiencing so much mental fog and overwhelming discomfort and a really strong sense of responsibility, too strong of a sense of responsibility, like feeling like, oh, if this situation didn't work out or this situation was really unhappy or fraught, it's all because of me and my behaviors, or that's what I deserve. And I do think we probably need to step back and talk about what cognitive dissonance is for any of our newer listeners. The metaphor that was used to explain it to me was just the smoking metaphor. So my therapist talked about the fact that cognitive dissonance is holding two contradictory beliefs at the same time. So for example, if you're an ultra marathon runner and you're on a vegan diet, yeah, you're smoking a pack of cigarettes every day. Those are two completely contradictory thoughts. And when that happens, your brain is going to work into overdrive to try to make sense of those two beliefs. And that's where we have the impact that Carrie and I have been talking about this time.
Yeah. It actually was in a webinar. Sandra Brown, I had interviewed her and she actually held her fists up in the air. She said it is a simultaneous creation of two realities, that the person who's the narcissist or a very pathological personality has two versions of themselves. There's the version that they created in order to convince you to be in the relationship with them. They've mimicked and mirrored you. So they've created a version, which is who you meet and you fall in love with. And they know that that's who you expect to see, but that isn't who they really are. So there's who they really are, and then there's the version that they've created in order to have this relationship with you. And what happens is that both versions exist in their minds, and they're trying to live in both versions, trying to be authentic to themselves to the degree that they know who they are. But they're also at the same time trying not to lose connection with you, because the more they're authentic to who they are and where they're at, the more likely you're not going to be in the relationship, because if you really knew them, you probably wouldn't have chosen them. And then they're also, though, at the same time trying to present who they think that you want to see. So you then create two realities inside of you. You create the version of, you sense something is off and that you're not seeing the full picture, and you see the irritable or the cross or the selfish or whatever other personality that's there. You see that personality, but you attribute it, and they do too, that, oh, they're having a bad moment, or they've gotten hungry, or due to the last fight or whatever. You're learning to deal with that difficult personality, and you also keep trying to encourage and coax and cooperate with the good personality that you think that they are. So you have had created two realities inside of you as well. So you're learning how to deal with both, and they're presenting both. And then what happens is that, just like you said, it's like asking the computer to solve an impossible solution. There isn't any recourse because of the duality. So you literally sit in this confusion with this picture that doesn't make sense. And your brain goes in overdrive, which is really scary, because we're not talking just overdrive like it's working too hard. We're talking that it's damaging the brain. They've done neuroimaging and found that the amygdala starts to swell because you feel so under threat, because something feels wrong. So it keeps saying, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? So that causes like irritableness, your difficulty sleeping. You're going to feel like you're on vigil, you're on guard, you're watching for what's something happening. You're walking on eggshells. It's going to create all that sensation. And your hippocampus is what you're describing. It's shrinking, which means then you're going to have memory problems. You're going to have some executive functioning issues. You're going to be more forgetful. You're going to feel scattered and not organized. So it's causing this kind of this syndrome of problems as a result of this dual reality. When she described that, like I said, it was a relief, because finally there were words to put into for what I had been going through that felt like something really wrong with me. And now it wasn't me. It was something that I was responding to. So for me, it was like this massive shift of view that really brought me a lot of relief.
And similar to, I actually felt relief when I discovered the reason behind my ex-husband's behavior. I shared a little bit about it before, but my ex was a drug addict, and I found drugs in our house right before my twins turned one. And when I found the drugs, and he admitted that they were his, because I actually hilariously found drugs a month before he finally admitted that they were his. When I found that, that was the turning point for me. That's when I suddenly felt so much relief. I have 15 years clean. That's a big part of my personal story, is that I got into recovery. And that is actually where I met my ex, was in recovery. And he actually did not stay clean much of our relationship. And I did not find out until we'd been together about 8 years that he'd been using secretly the entire time we'd been together. And so when I found that, that was the moment of relief for me. So it wasn't all this swirling, what's the problem? Is the problem me? How do I fix me? I need therapy. I need books. I need whatever. That it was, oh, there's an actual thing that has been hidden from me that I didn't know the whole story of. And that is this thing. It didn't make my next steps or my path any easier, because I mean, it was figuring out what to do with the relationship after that. But that was the moment of relief for me, is that it was this thing that was outside of me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting you're saying that. Someone got a hold of me this week that her partner has passed away, and she just discovered that he'd been living this secret double life. It's completely unpacking. And I also know, I'm trying to think of the name of the actress. She just recently passed away in her 50s, I think, or 60s. She wrote her sister wrote a story about their father, who also lived a second double life. It's called Anonymous, is the name of the book. For me, what happened with me is all the way through the dating And right up to 2 months into the marriage, so we're talking 13, 14 months, my ex was living a complete double life. He had a secret hidden life. I found out on the last night of our honeymoon when somebody contacted me and exposed the duplicity that had been going on. But then I still stayed with him for 2 more years because the second duplicity that got then put into place was that he was trying and working really hard and we were in treatment and that this was just sort of the recovery. But what I discovered when the marriage was all over and near the end of it, that all of that was a lie. That was, so the first was, oh, he had two lives, like many lives actually. And then the second was, oh, he's really working hard. And then I discovered, actually, no, he was just getting really better at deception. He wasn't working hard at it. It was all of it was just lip service. And that there actually was probably a bigger lie, and that was the marriage was never actually a real thing. Not in his opinion, it wasn't. But I'll tell you, living with somebody who's creating that, in fact, that's what makes me so upset. Somebody got a hold of me this weekend about a video or something and said I needed to stop being so hard on narcissists. They're actually good people who just have had a really lousy life. And that, yeah, literally said that they're just good people who've had a lousy life. And that he knew nice people who are narcissists. And I just need to get off my high horse that I was projecting. I love to say, you must be the narcissist, which is why you're talking about this. Like, even that logic to me, it doesn't add up, makes no sense. But what people don't understand, I think first of all, he's probably not a very healthy person. That's why he's attacking me. He probably feels triggered by what I'm saying. But what people who don't understand about what we're talking about, we're not, abuse is always bad. But what narcissistic abuse does, it's something additionally, it's something that's different. It's a deception. It's a deception. There is something a person is not sharing, and there's some way in which they, who they really are, they're not coming forth on, and they're creating this massive illusion, and then they want you to live in the illusion and pretend the reality actually isn't happening. Now that I'm thinking about this, I had a client that I spent years with that knew there was something that her husband wasn't telling her. And I remember how she wobbled in and out, and we had spent all this time in therapy, and I didn't know about cognitive dissonance, and I couldn't help her with that piece, except that I watched her in all this pain, trying to figure out what was real about her relationship. Now I know what she was experiencing. Now I would have been a very different course of treatment. I feel bad that I didn't know what I didn't know at the time, but that's what you and I are talking about, is this, it's a massive deception. And we get exploited because of the deception, and it does damage. The deception doesn't just mess with us. It doesn't just cost us money, time, and our health, but it actually is damaging us physically to be living in a deception.
Yeah, I can speak a lot to that.
I get mad just thinking about it.
I actually have an interesting story with a con that actually benefited me. As I said, my ex and I met in a 12-step program, and I have 15 years clean today, and I stayed clean the entire time we were in a relationship, even though he was actively using. Okay, so part of our relationship is we would attend meetings together. We would do volunteer work for the fellowship together. We sponsored other people through the fellowship. He did that all while secretly, actively using. We even would, whenever we traveled, I would make sure that we would go to meetings in these other areas. We'd go meet people. We'd exchange numbers. And his con was intense. You go to a meeting every meeting and you say, I'm so-and-so and I'm an addict. And that implies that you're willing to be clean. He celebrated birthdays when he wasn't clean. He celebrated 10 years and didn't have any clean time. So that level of con was so intense that, and it did benefit me. It did benefit me that I don't know if I had discovered earlier if I might have relapsed myself. I don't know. At the time when I found the drugs, I knew exactly what to do. I had a plan of action. And in another way that it benefited me is I had several surgeries while I was in recovery. And part of what you do with a surgery, if you're in recovery of any kind, is you give someone else that pain medicine, that narcotic, to manage for you. He was always the one that managed my narcotics, and he made sure I didn't over abuse or overuse them. And at times, he even encouraged me to quit early. He was like, you don't need it anymore. And at the time, that was a benefit for me. He was then using my remaining narcotics without me knowing. I thought he was disposing of them, but it still ended up benefiting me that I didn't. My recovery was great. My recovery was in a good place. And that's something I can actually thank him for. even though it was very selfishly motivated and all for his con.
His exploitation was helpful.
Yes. In that case, yes.
Jeez. Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah. So I think we kind of like today focused on what it looks like when you're in the thick of it and what you might be experiencing. I guess there's a couple things I'd like people to take away, and I'd love to know what you want people to take away from this. I would love, if any of this is resonating with somebody who's listening today, I would love them to look closer at their relationship and wonder if there is really a deception. They're good at hiding this. They're really good, and they're really good at making you feel bad for questioning them. But what I found super helpful and was writing things down, and literally almost like a script. They said, I said, they said, I said, they did this, I did this. And what I found was when I went back and looked at what I've written and asked myself some critical questions, like, does what they're saying line up with what they're doing? Or another one I would say would be, does love really treat people like, I mean, I love people. Do I treat them like this? What would a loving action look like here? I found that when I did that, it helped me to begin to see things in a completely new way. Let's go back to what you and I have both said. The cognitive dissonance is creating confusion. Our mind literally is in a state of like almost like it just can't figure out. It can't compute, literally can't compute. But when you see it on paper, it gives you a chance to interact with it externally. So it helps you to get through the confusion so that maybe you can compute it and it makes a little more sense. So that's what I would love. Like, if this sounds familiar, if you're in this, please know it's not you. It's something that's happening to you. And there are some ways to help begin to get help, but also get help. I mean, I think that's the other thing I'd really love to leave people with. Please get help because you need that support. This is another thing I had to do for myself. I had to say, just because this person's doing shameful things or saying weird things that are embarrassing, it's not me. I need to be able to say that. That just because they're saying shameful things or doing odd things, that not to take ownership for that and to have a safe person that I can actually say these things out loud to, they can sit with me and help me to see that. But that they have to be the right person. I really want to urge people to make sure they're seeing a coach or a counselor that provides a lot of safety, a lot of space where you don't feel judged, that you can just be yourself. That went a long way. I had a therapist near the end who was like that, and it really helped me to begin to sort of say things out loud so that we could see the truth for what it was.
I think I just wanted to come back to your point of just that intense emotional pain. I think that's something that's very important for us to look at and really not discount and really not try to talk away or internalize or make it all about us. That intense emotional pain is never okay or normal in a relationship. And I think that's something that I would hope some people would take away. It's just what you mentioned, that it is this long-standing, intense emotional pain that with this mental fog and lack of clarity and executive functioning issues, that it is this thing that may not have a clear explanation for why that thing is happening, because you may not know what duplicity is happening, but at least you can get a sense of, oh, this it is happening likely because of cognitive dissonance. And remembering that that's not normal, it's not okay. I really tried to normalize it. I would take these little quotes that people would say, like marriage is hard, or you know, it's always work. I would take that and think that I was oversensitive or something. That like, oh, this is the hard part of working hard. You know what I mean? And I really had to learn that that's just not normal. And now that I'm married again, it's really not.
Yeah, I agree with you. And for me, it showed up in a different way. I think it's really important for those who are in a religious framework or a religious mindset. That's where I was at. And there's a lot of pressure around maintaining a marriage and making a commitment and being true to your commitment, having integrity about that. I was feeling really a lot of guilt. And I had to find a new way to see it, that a loving God would not want his creation treated like this, and that somebody who's lying and creating a false perception of what really is the relationship's about, that they've already themselves broke the vows, that me following through on my behavior to that deception is just a natural consequence to somebody who's maybe never even made a commitment or certainly is not keeping their commitments. And that helped me feel freer than to take the actions because I was totally guilt-ridden. I mean, totally. That really controlled me and kept me stuck because I wanted to be a good wife and I wanted to honor God. So I just felt paralyzed by it all. Well, there's a whole lot to say about what happens inside of a cognitive dissonance when you're in a relationship. We have a lot more to say about this. I know we'll circle the back into this, but I'm really glad we talk about this. What I really appreciate about this is because this is the thing that keeps people confused and they stay because they think there's something wrong with them and they think they don't know that this is actually the relationship that's causing a deterioration. So I'm really glad we got into this today.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to learn more just about cognitive dissonance, you cover it in episode 24, which is helpful too. Today's self-help tip is on getting back to basics. So as I mentioned earlier in this episode, I'm a member of a 12-step fellowship. And 12-step fellowships, we often use the phrase HALT. And HALT stands for hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And when I was in the middle of my incredibly unhealthy relationship, and also after when I was attempting to recover, I really needed to get back to basics of taking care of my physical self. And so if I was feeling overrun or exhausted, or I didn't really know what I was feeling, I would go through that. I'm like, am I hungry? And then I would go get myself food. Am I angry? Do I need to go like take a run or punch a pillow? Am I lonely? Do I need to reach out to a safe friend? Am I tired? Do I need to take a nap? It really helped me get reconnected with my physical body and working on caring for it again, because I stopped caring for it completely when I was in that really unhealthy relationship.
I love how it just sort of asks us to be more mindful. Now that you've listened to the episode, are you feeling agonizing indecisiveness? Is it possible that you're experiencing cognitive dissonance? If you need help finding support, please reach out to either myself or Tara. We'd be happy to direct you towards someone with an expertise in this area or to help you become a member of my Toxic Free Club. And consider using HALT. That was a new idea to me. Let me know if it helps you improve your self-care. You can always email us at hello@breakingfreewithcarrietara.com. And if you haven't, make sure that you follow and subscribe to this podcast. Leave us a review and let us know what you think of the show. Maybe you know someone who might benefit from today's episode. Make sure to share it with them. And if you're not following us on social media, you can check out Tara at tara.relationshipcoach or me at Carrie McAvoy, PhD. And we'll see you back here next Monday when we talk about sex and narcissism.